Testing.
Here we go. It looks so pretty. Those big blue, you know, wavelengths.
Little wavies.
I'd love to see it. Yeah. Okay. Welcome back to... Yeah. I'll do my little intro and then we'll banter. Maybe I'll keep this in. We'll see. Welcome back to American Scene, the show where we talk about movies with American in the title and what they say about American identity, culture, and values. I'm Ben Rosen, and in honor of Valentine's Day, of course, we're here to talk about the 1906... Oh my gosh.
Sex. Yes!
1906!
I mean, there's a lot of that happening.
They weren't showing it, but, you know, they talk about it in the movie that they weren't having it.
It's true. Segway.
We're talking about the 1967 film Divorce, American Style. Joining me for her second appearance on the show, you've already heard her voice, you know her, you love her. The last time we spoke was all the way back in 2020, our last general election year. Talking about the American president, back again, it's Haley Palmer.
Hello.
It's been a few months. It took a little while. How are you?
I'm good. I'm prepping for Valentine's Day. I got a bottle of wine with my name on it.
Yeah? Are you sharing some chocolates with Zoe?
Oh, 100%. For those of you who don't know, Zoe is my cat. She's delightful. But yeah, we're going to have some catnip, some wine, do a little Pinot meow. Is that a pun? Please edit that out.
We're going to keep it. We're absolutely keeping it.
God damn it. But yeah, no, life's good. But thanks so much for having me. I love this podcast. It's great to be back. And this was a great movie to check out, too.
I'm so glad you picked it because there's so much to talk about. Mm-hmm. I sent you like a few choices. I was like, we got to do a comedy. I did do a couple Christmas comedies, and I'm glad I fit those in. Both of those ended up being a lot sadder than I expected. But I had been doing a lot of crime movies, going to be doing a lot more crime movies. And this one is not just a comedy, but gives us so much to talk about.
It's a little dark, too. It's my favorite kind of comedy.
It's a little cynical, mm-hmm. a little skeptical of the issues it's bringing up.
Yeah, the best comedy is.
I like getting a view of a different era. And I said this episode is in honor of Valentine's Day. Obviously, I meant that ironically. But this episode is also a genuine celebration of the late, great Norman Lear, who passed away just a couple months ago at the beginning of December, around the time we were planning to record this episode. And then I said, let's wait till Valentine's Day. That makes sense to do an episode on divorce.
He'd be proud.
Yeah, he would appreciate the irony.
I think so.
Lear was a TV titan, but before creating the hit series All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Maude, Good Times, One Day at a Time, and The Jeffersons, he wrote the screenplays for the 1963 Frank Sinatra movie Come Blow Your Horn, based on the Neil Simon play. Do you know that one?
I don't, but I love Neil Simon.
I have to check it out.
Yeah.
He also wrote the 1968 William Friedkin film The Night They Raided Minsky's, and of course, the screenplay for Divorce, American Style, for which he earned his only Oscar nomination. I think he has many Emmys to his name.
Yeah.
But this was his only Oscar nomination.
And it was the only one for the film.
It was the film's only Oscar nomination, although we'll get into it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of great talent behind this movie.
It's an impressive crew and cast.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of the cast, Divorce American Style stars Dick Van Dyke, Debbie Reynolds, Jason Robards, and Gene Simmons. After 17 years of marriage, affluent suburban couple Richard and Barbara Harmon decide to call it quits. In the divorce, Richard loses his home, his car, and much of his salary due to alimony payments, while Barbara attempts to find love with a couple different characters, including one person whose life is already a complicated web of children, divorce, and remarriage. Mm-hmm. Wonderful scene in the film. Richard meets Nelson Downs, who's trying to marry off his ex-wife Nancy so that he can be free of his own alimony payments, but Richard can't afford to marry her while he's only making $87.30 a week, which I think we did the math. It's like $800 a week in 2024.
Honestly, it's not bad.
Not bad.
It's not bad. We've all been there. But, you know, if he's used to a certain lifestyle... Mm-hmm. Sure. I'll give it to him.
Yeah. So things aren't going well. Nelson. They should have that couple's name, I think.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. Nelson and Nancy plot to set up Barbara with a millionaire auto dealer, but after they start seeing each other and just before their divorce is finalized, Richard and Barbara decide to stay together. Did they learn anything along the way about how to better communicate or be effective partners to each other? I don't think so, because they immediately start arguing again.
They were an average American couple.
Why all you care about is what's
minute with you anyway. You just
see and after 15 years of marriage...
There's something wrong. We're choking to death.
I'll call the fire department.
There was only one thing left to do.
Divorce?
If you're not divorced, you're about to be. I know the look.
But I haven't said anything about a divorce.
Now, Richard and Barbara Harmon...
Hate? Who said anything about hate?
...are about to discover...
When a marriage is over, it feels like something you've only read about.
...that being single again...
I'm lonely, Mr. Harmon.
...isn't all it's cracked up to be.
No! The only miracle in marriage is that two people find each other in the first place.
Dick Van Dyke, Debbie Reynolds, Jason Robards, and Gene Simmons in a film about life, love, and divorce American style.
What did you think of the movie? Let's just start there.
It's so funny. The fact that you just said that, because they start to argue again. It's interesting because arguing is healthy. Arguing is healthy part of relationships. It's part of being a human being, having some conflict. However, that wasn't the message in this ending as well. Definitely bickering back to the same patterns. But I will say, I did like the realism, having some bickering. To answer your question, did I like this movie? If I had to say yes or no, I'm going to say no.
Wow.
I'm going to say no.
Wow.
I would recommend... I would say no. I would say no. I'm glad I watched it. I learned a lot about the decade. The writing is fun. The acting is great. I think the issue I just had with it was just the story structure. I lost momentum. But when I watched it a second time, I was able to anticipate what was happening. So I was able to be like, all right, next plot point, next plot point. Yeah, well, that's kind of where I'm at. But I'm glad I watched it. And I got a lot of thoughts on divorce.
Oh, boy. Boy, do we. Yeah. I definitely feel that. Would I recommend it? It wouldn't be the first thing I recommend.
That's it.
Certainly, if you want a Norman Lear project, maybe stick to his TV is probably a better way to go.
I think that's it.
And the first time, it was definitely slow. The first 40 minutes is extremely claustrophobic. Like, they don't... It's an hour and 40-minute movie, and they don't decide to get divorced until, like, minute 40. So it takes a little while to just hear them arguing back and forth, and it's very basically, like, in the home that entire time. And it's a little just very uncomfortable.
Ben, you know what? I just realized why I dislike it so much in the beginning. I, as Hayley Palmer, hate conflict. I hate listening to people fight. I hate having to confront someone about something. And you're totally right. The cinematography was stunning. The direction was great. The acting was great because they were just straight up fighting and they weren't big blowout fights. Some of them were. But for the first 40 minutes, it was a slow progression of just the day-to-day minutiae of bickering. And I was so awkward and uncomfortable. It's why I don't like watch reality TV. I don't like watching it because I hate conflict. Mm. So I think that's it. It's not to discredit or call the movie bad. I think I just feel uncomfortable with conflict.
Yeah, it was uncomfortable. From the opening scene when this guy comes on, it's very theatrical.
Oh, yeah.
Sets up his conductor. Sets up at the top of this hill overlooking suburbia, and all the men are coming home in their cars to their wives, and he starts conducting, and it's like this is the chaos of normal everyday life, and it really is. And you hear the arguments behind each of the doors, and there you're hearing like what is the conflict between each of these different couples, and you don't see any of it because from the outside it all looks very pristine and well decorated and well adorned, traditional. We talked about kind of the aesthetics of American suburbia on our American Beauty episode, and how that's like a genre unto itself of like suburban drama and the
like
stuff
Don't Worry Darling
underneath.
It's like
all Don't Worry Darling. Yeah, sure. Truman Show. I just watched The Ice Storm recently. It's a very sad movie. And then you open the door and everybody's smiling. It's a party. Yeah. It's just like a normal weeknight party at the Harmon's place.
Yeah.
And it's all these close-ups. It's all these like really, really tight shots on
claustrophobia.
I would not want to be at that party.
Lots of cheek loud. Kissing.
Lots of smoking.
It is so funny. I saw your commentary. Just you mentioned earlier, like it makes you want to have like an asthma attack. You can feel it coming on. Where I was sitting here being like, I could do a cigarette right now. I was just like, I get the vibe. I'm stressed.
I see them emptying the ashtrays at the end of the party.
So gross.
Like, oh my God.
It's so gross. So much,
it's really gross.
How bad does their furniture smell?
That's, I could not stop thinking about that.
Disgusting.
My aunt lives next door to someone who smoked for a long time, and my aunt does not smoke. Mm-mm. But her place smells like, so her bedroom smells like smoke.
You gotta move.
Because of that. Oh no, it's rent control. Yeah, no.
You gotta get used to it.
For life. Yep. She is used to it. Always takes an adjustment for me whenever I visit her.
I do like, though, essentially to go back to your point, do you like the movie? Was it a good movie? It was a good movie. It was a good film. Great cast, great crew. I loved the, for being premiered in 1967, really cool commentary on divorce and flipping it on its head. And also just talking about the corruption is a strong word, but it's a screwed up system. It's not really fair. The alimony payments, all of that fun stuff. But I do think we can dive into this later. There is some like blatant sexism in the movie that I don't think was intentional. And we can jump into that later.
We'll definitely get into it. I understand where it comes from. We'll get into that. I'm looking forward to that. Okay.
Yeah.
We already talked about all the, like, how well-made this film is.
Oh, yeah.
So I just want to shout out, the movie also features cinematography by Conrad Hall, who won Oscars for American Beauty, along with Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and Road to Perdition. Love all those movies.
Mm-hmm.
He was also nominated for... Oh, no, wait. Did I check and see he was not nominated for Cool Hand Luke this year?
Oh, let's check.
Great. Now I have to... yeah. Now I have to double check that. But the cinematography in Cool Hand Luke is incredible. But he did work on that the same year. And the music is by Dave Grusin, who won his Oscar for a movie I have never heard of, The Milagro Beanfield War. But he also was nominated for 7 other films, including Heaven Can Wait, Tootsie, and The Firm. Have you seen the original Heaven Can Wait? That it's been like different versions. They also did like a version. I think it was like
Down to Earth with Chris Rock. Is Warren Beatty in that one?
Chris Rock. I believe it is Warren Beatty, yeah.
I think I had when I was a kid. My mom's like, you're related to him. And I'm like, I'm bored. And I left. I don't think I finished it.
I think we did Heaven Can Wait. I think that was one of the plays we did in high school. It's been so long. But great music, great cinematography,
yeah.
Great editing, great costumes, great writing, obviously, nominated. But yeah, it takes a little, maybe a little adjustment. It's not necessarily in keeping with a lot of the other 60s movies that you might think of from this era, like Cool Hand Luke or like Bonnie and Clyde or like The Graduate. It feels like a movie from a few years prior.
A touch. I will say I did like how it was a little edgy and artistic. Like, especially with, The Graduate, there are these really pretty long shots. And you could tell they're, of course, now looking back on it, they may seem stereotypical, but they were so beautifully original at the time of, like, sitting in the back of a cab staring straight forward or whatever. Like, these long, long shots. I feel like that was on par with this one, of these really kind of avant-garde for the time close-ups and, like, cheek kissing. So I think it was a little edgy there. But you're right, thematically speaking, it felt very 50s.
Yeah, this is the oldest movie we've talked about now on the show. The previous movie was American Graffiti, which came out in 1973, looking back at the summer of 1962. And Alan and I talked about how that movie is really painting a picture of America right before some huge moments and social shifts, the civil rights movement, the Cuban Missile Crisis, Vietnam escalation, the assassinations of JFK and Malcolm X, and then in 1968, Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. This movie comes out in 1967. What do you think about when you think about this era sociopolitically, culturally?
I definitely think of, we talked about it before, of feminine mystique. As you mentioned, it was written in 1963. Just pretty much... It was an eye-opening book for so many women and men, all people, about the norms, the gender roles in marriage, and how if you don't want to, you don't need to fit into them. There's nothing wrong with fitting into the gender norms if that brings you joy, but you don't have to. And I think when that book came out, women were realizing, oh, I'm not really happy with this being my day-to-day chore. of when the kids are napping, I can't have a break. This is the time to clean dishes. This is the time to do this. There's no break. Then your partner comes home, and of course they're tired, and all they want to do is have a meal for them. This woman, this caretaker, never has a moment to themselves. And then fast forward 20 years later, deep depression, and that's where they're at. So having that book come out and allowing women and partners to be like, I'm not happy, was pivotal, really important. And we talked about as well, we'll get there later. But essentially just how divorce, you know, in the 60s, after this book came out, after there was this feminist uprising, the divorce rates went up. And I think that's why this is a perfect movie for the time, because it shows you people are probably experiencing this. This is why I love film. It reflects what's happening today. Studios are producing films and putting it out into a world where the audience, they want to see that content. Currently, in the past 20 years, 15 years, we've been loving superhero movies. At this time in the 60s, people wanted to see the day-to-day life of domestic living. And they wanted to maybe see themselves in the films. And they're like, hey, I'm going through a divorce. This is relatable. So I think this was a good time. It's reflective of the time. And that's what I think of when I think of the 60s.
Yeah, you definitely see an ability for people to actually have these conversations that were not previously being had. I think something like Feminine Mystique being published then and then becoming popular at the same time that seeking counseling, seeking psychological help, finding therapy is becoming popularized. So you have these conversations about emotions and needs and communication and happiness and fulfillment in your life and in your marriage that you weren't necessarily having before. And to your point about seeing real life being reflected in the movies, and this is also at the tail end of the Hays Code era of filmmaking. So there was a version of life that was being portrayed in film that was not realistic, that did not have the kind of gray areas and shades of you know, good, bad, you know, somewhere in the middle that real life has, the kind of uncertainty or, you know, anti-heroes, you know,
vulnerability.
Sure. Yeah.
You want to be able to like see yourself or see these people express feelings that maybe you don't feel comfortable expressing in your day-to-day life.
Yeah. And send messages that maybe weren't, you know, simplistic and moral. And this movie comes out at the tail end of the 60s when you get other stuff like Night of the Living Dead and In the Heat of the Night and Easy Rider and Midnight Cowboy and Bonnie and Clyde, ushering in really like the 70s cinema where you get, you know, folks like Scorsese and Coppola and Spielberg and all these Paul Schrader, all these great filmmakers that are touching on much darker things, much grittier aspects of life. This all starts to build in the 60s, and as you mentioned, the divorce rate starts going up. In 1969, we get the first law that allows for no-fault divorce. So that's one of the reasons the divorce rate goes up, right? Because suddenly you can get one.
Well, I think also, too, it's so interesting. You mentioned just about the times and about, you know, educating yourselves when it comes to feminine mystique and people wanting to see counselors. One of my favorite quotes of this movie is in the beginning. It was like 12 minutes in. Our main character, he pretty much just goes, boy, the day I said you could see a marriage counselor, the day I said you could see him, I should have cut my throat. So clearly, this script it's mirroring what is happening in society. People were seeing marriage therapists and counselors, and it was out of the norm. It's a new thing now. People were reading this book. People were discovering themselves, what they wanted, and they're thinking maybe therapy isn't for quote-unquote people who are unwell. It could just be for people who want some feedback. And the husband was so uncomfortable with this step. I think, and I could be wrong, but I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on this. But I think the writer made therapy sound like a negative thing as opposed to encouraging it. I think the writer, and it was comical, but the writer made the therapist take a side, it sounds like. It was like the therapist and her were ganging up on him. And to me, as a if I were a couple watching this, I wouldn't want to go to therapy after that. So I think it's an interesting time where it's commenting on the times. I don't think it's as progressive as, of course, I want it to be. But it's what it is.
Well, the therapist, it feels very cliche in the portrayal. Like, he's got this sort of vague Eastern European accent. You know, he's certainly, you know, sort of Freud-coded, even if he doesn't say anything about, you know, Richard's mom. But he does immediately go to sex, right? And Richard's comfortability talking about sex. So, yes, I think the writer is definitely skeptical of what exactly is the kind of advice or guidance that a therapist is providing to women specifically, and also showing the skepticism and maybe hesitance that persists today of men seeking therapy. I don't know that much has changed in terms of, like, Richard, who he is in his, you know, solidly middle class, son of a blue-collar family, you know, in suburbia with the wife and kids. Like, this person in 2024 doesn't necessarily think that they need to go to therapy either, and might be skeptical of, you know, well, don't we have everything we need? Isn't this what we've been working for? Mm-hmm. You know, so why aren't we, you know, we should be happy, you know, so why, you know, what's a therapist going to tell me?
This episode brought to you by BetterHelp.
If only.
It's not, but yeah, check it out.
Gosh, yeah, I'd love, sure, the sponsorship money.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
No, it's totally true. I think when it comes to changing of the times, and we're going to get to this later, but talking about how is today different than 1967, of course, we'll get into the stats, but a big one is therapy becoming the norm and becoming accepted. Maybe that's just me in my liberal bubble in New York City, but I do feel like it's a very common thing. I'll see on dating apps and it'll say, like, a green flag of mine, I go to therapy. People love talking about it. So I feel like that's a nice progress. And it had to start somewhere. You have to make fun of something first in order to get comfortable and then get into it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we didn't note about these characters is we're about the same ages as them. They got married when they were like 19 or 20 years old, and so Richard's like 35 in this movie, and Barbara's maybe 33.
Nuts. Okay, so I'm glad that you mentioned, gosh, that. I got some stats for y'all. In 1967, the average age of marriage was 23 for men and 21 for women. Ben, question for you. Mm-hmm. What do you think the numbers are in 2024?
Well, I did read the article you sent me, so I'm going to guess that it's, like, still pretty young, and the average age for men is 26, and for women is 23?
So it's interesting. I did send you that article, but I found another article.
Okay.
So who knows what stat is true, but the one that I'm referring to, which I think is more accurate, I set you up for failure just now, Ben.
That's okay.
The average age for men in 2024 is 30 and 28 for women.
Wow.
This checks out to me.
Okay. Yeah. No, that seems right.
And you know what's even cooler? In 1940, I have all the stats right here, and I'm so proud of the stats. In 1940, 7.7% of households were one person. In 2020, that number shot up to almost 30% of people being single in their household, single household. So I love that. I'm all about that.
That's so interesting. That might be another episode, because, mm-hmm, as we'll talk about later, like, can we afford it?
Exactly.
Can we afford to be single?
Yeah.
But it definitely shows probably a cultural shift of it being acceptable to stay single, mm-hmm, in your own household. Yeah. So yeah, we teased earlier about what this movie is saying about divorce. And maybe not some very kind things about women in this
just
movie.
It's like a smattering. It wasn't like anti-woman. It was just a little, like films do, you know, just little sprinkles.
Little jabs.
Little chestnuts.
Pokes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So what makes an American-style divorce in this time period? What's the movie telling us?
I think a great way to start for this question of what does this movie tell us? What makes a divorce American is the poster itself. The poster itself is Dick Van Dyke and his boxers. The American flag is covering his boxers. So he almost looks naked, incredibly vulnerable and weak. There's a hand behind him. The hand has a wedding band and it's chained to a ball and chain, and it has money on it. All of these assets are in this gigantic purse, money, car, house, everything you need to live and survive. Debbie Reynolds' character is in this gorgeous, like, pink boa and dress, leaning over it, wearing pearls, laughing at him. So to me...
What could it be saying? I don't know. It seems so subtle.
To me... I would take away an American divorce is when the woman screws over the man. That, to me, is the argument that this film is trying to make, in my opinion. I think it's also just an easy stance to take. It can be funny. It's slapsticky. Everyone has an archetype. You lean into your characters. But I just really kept getting this narrative that women are villains and men are the victims in divorce. Women are out to get them and their money. And because women have sought out therapists, because women have educated themselves, they want freedom, and that's meant to screw you over, men. So keep an eye on your women, make sure that they're in line, and don't let them divorce you. That was the mentality I took. Yes, it's a hot take. I don't think that was a conscious decision on the writer's behalf. But that was my take, especially when you look at the stats of people who are divorced. Women are far less better off. And it's just a narrative. It bummed me out. But I will say, it was funny.
Yeah, it's a funny looking poster, but you're right. Yeah, I would say, mm-hmm. I'll push back on you on 2 points, which is, I would say it is intentional.
Okay.
But that it is not, it's not necessarily saying women are evil, but the system has enabled women to have all of the power in the courts and to take advantage of that, that now if you can get a divorce, oh, well, now they can just take everything from you, especially after no-fault divorce. It's like, well, now they can just, you know, for any reason at all, you know, or the scene with the lawyers, which we have to talk about that scene with the lawyers. It's saying intentionally men are at a disadvantage in divorce, certainly, and that women can and will take everything, perhaps out of malice, but perhaps just, you know, the courts are going to do it anyway. The lawyers are going to do it anyway. This is just rote for them.
What does it sound like to you? Defendant was insulting and demeaning. Defendant was cruel, abusive, often sadistic. Defendant threatened severe bodily harm to the plaintiff's person. What does that sound like?
Well, I didn't know it said that. Well, it's true. I would never say anything like that. David has twisted my words. There's no reason for anything.
I have explained to clients, don't take it so personal. It's just the way these things are written. Which the court accepts prima facie.
I've used the identical language.
Allowed to the court. That's a formal charge.
You golf, don't you, David?
Certainly.
Haven't I run into you out at Longview? In a foursome with Milt Vincent. Hey, that's a great course, Longview, huh? The dining room's pretty good, too. Ever try the steak tartare at Hillside? You can't touch the lobster Louis at Longview. Why don't we get a foursome together some weekend?
Yeah.
18 holes, a little lunch, huh? Well, it's a date. Well, you folks ready to continue now?
In the scene with the lawyers, like, Richard's lawyer is doodling, which is like, so he's not taking this seriously. He's not putting up a fight against Barbara and her lawyer. And then the two lawyers break to talk about golf. This is all so routine for them. Richard refers to taking his case to Nuremberg. Like, losing property and money in a divorce is a war crime. And the movie suggests that courts are merciless to men. His lawyer doesn't even fight for him in the court. Meanwhile, Barbara has all her friends there to support her, and her lawyers are like, her lawyer's offering to take her to this like big celebratory lunch, which, again, the reality of it is that's just not the case. I think it's also interesting, the little jabs we talked about. The movie goes out of its way to downplay a homemaker's role, which is really like has never really been recognized in reality, of like what the value of a homemaker is, what they provide to making the homework. And this movie goes out of its way to say, like, oh, well, not much. They just hang around and, you know, live off the fat of the land, right? Barbara cooks breakfast once, and it's treated like it's out of the norm, special occasion. Nancy mentions she had a professional help with all the home design, but she got to choose the ashtrays, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, really minimizing, like, their effect on the home. Barbara and Richard also have a house cleaner, so it's not like Barbara even does any of the cleaning, right? And then the other time Barbara cooks, she burns the steaks. Mm-hmm. You know, so, like, there's never a part of the movie where it's, like, showing, oh, no, Barbara's actually contributing to what this marriage has looked like and what has, yeah, sure, Richard keeps saying, oh, look, I bought the home and I did this and I did that. And it's like, well, what has Barbara been doing this whole time?
Yeah.
And the movie says, like, not much.
Yeah. Or also, too, like, you see him start to pick up some of the dishes and he's furious. And I'm thinking, like, you live here, man. Pick up a cup. But yeah, no, I think that's an excellent point. Agreed. You make an interesting point about the movie showing that men, initially with the courts, maybe right off the bat, get the short end of the stick. There was an article that talked about divorce outcomes and consequences. And granted, this was during, you know, this study was between the 80s and the late 90s. It was an interesting observation. And of course, time periods are different, decades are different. But it's interesting, it lines up to what you were saying, Ben. They noticed that in the short term, men were more vulnerable to short-term consequences for their well-being. Maybe they started to have to pay alimony, which they weren't used to. Maybe they had to downsize, whatever it may be. Also, side note, bizarre how women was just expected to take the children. That's not always fair, but whatever. They noticed in the study that men in this scenario, when they get a divorce, they typically adapt quickly to this lifestyle and they recover quickly. They are more likely to remarry or find a partner, mainly because they aren't taking care of the kids. When it comes to the woman, it's so much harder for her long term. They experience disproportionate losses in household income, increased risk of poverty, single parenting. And it's interesting how right off the bat, yes, we see in this movie the first year. And that is the men getting hit the hardest is the first year, which the stats kind of reflect. But long term, it hurts the women so much more.
Yeah, I'm glad we're getting into stats and, like, the reality, because that is, like, the most important part of talking about divorce and talking about this movie. And I just want to read this quote. And this is from, well, this is from the quote itself is from a 1959 article in Red Book. And I found this quote having read this book, Divorce American Style, which I...
Coincidence?
I was Googling books about divorce and, like, evolution from the 60s to today. And I just happened to find this book, Divorce American Style by Suzanne Kahn. I mean, really, really highly recommended if you're... It's actually not even that long a book. It's like 250 pages taking you from... the start of no-fault divorces in 1969 through the 2000s. But the quote from Red Book is, it told readers, most divorced women do not suffer as much as we think they do. Most divorced men suffer more than we realize. A divorced woman has lost her husband. A divorced man has lost not only a wife, but very often his children, his home, his possessions, his savings, many of his old friends, and much of his self-esteem. The article continued to express sympathy for the hardships created by alimony, explaining that a divorced man's chances for happiness in any new marriage are constantly threatened by the persistent demands of the old one, his obligations to pay alimony mortgages his future earnings and impedes his ability to make a new life for himself.
Is he not supposed to pay for his kids? What's the deal with the alimony complaint? Like, those are your children! Ugh.
Yes.
Great quote, though. Carry on.
Yes. It is a very frustrating quote, but that viewpoint held a lot of sway. And certainly, totally. I think this movie reflects that. Now, in reality, as the book explains, alimony, not guaranteed. Mm-mm. Child support payments and alimony, not necessarily enforced. Mm-mm. You know, and especially if the guy wasn't making any money. Like, how do you enforce this person to pay for to support his kids, but didn't, you know, those payments were also determined by judges who were predominantly men, who maybe either didn't have the discretion or didn't know they had the discretion to take certain things into account. Like in the case of this movie, Richard just became a general manager. He's young, he's 35, right? Barbara's never worked a day in her life. She's been home with the kids. The kids are like 15 years old. So as long as they've been married, pretty much, she's been at home. So yeah, she is dependent on Richard. And but maybe some judges often would not always give out alimony, would not always provide that or enforce that. Men might not live up to paying that full amount as well. Often did not. So this movie sort of assumes that alimony, child support, always there, always enforced, nothing you can do about it, and the women take everything. And that's just not the case. Mm-hmm. Has never been the case.
It's fear-mongering a little bit.
You also have to consider, you know, women didn't create the system.
Mm-hmm.
Men created the system. So it's just kind of rich that in the aftermath of like a divorce or in the aftermath of a marriage not working out, that men would then find reason to complain about the system they created. Oh, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. What was I going to say? It doesn't matter. I was listening and then I forgot my comment, but I totally agree.
Yeah. Well, I'll just add to that. I mean, you know, other things, again, really recommend the book if you want to understand more about how divorce has changed and kind of the selective entitlements and benefits that can be earned after going through a divorce. But in 1965, basically the only law that was on the books in terms of benefits was if you were married 20 or more years, then if that marriage were to end, then either person could claim Social Security benefits, on the other person's Social Security benefits. So for instance, say he's entitled to $800 a week, then he'll still get his full benefit and she would get $400. That was the only federal benefit on the books in 1965. And it was later reduced to 10 years.
Hmm.
But still, like, as of the 2000s, the Social Security Administration, if you were married less than 10 years, it would just say you were never married because it just, like, in their eyes, it didn't count.
Yeah.
Very, very strange system. But that was, like, kind of the only outside of alimony and child support, if it was ruled that way by a judge and enforced, you could get that as well, and split up community property. But often, if the car was in his name, depending on the state, if the house was in his name, she would have no claim to it. So just very much at a disadvantage. Women were at a disadvantage in this era,
for sure. I just remembered though what I was gonna say. But essentially, yes. But when it comes to in the defense of people who are the fear mongering, at least when it comes to the idea of divorce being something to fear, and it is a very heartbreaking process. No one's going to enjoy this process. It's heartbreaking. But I feel like any change in the status quo is scary. So whether it is your day-to-day life that's a change, that is very scary. If society is changing, if more people are breaking up their marriages, what you know to be true and stable and your touchstone is now totally shaken and destroyed, that is scary. People are going to freak out. And that, in their defense, is a human quality. It makes sense when people are afraid or they get angry or they get defensive.
Yeah, it would be maybe we need a remake.
Maybe we need a remake.
We've talked about that on the show before, where it was like, man, something about this just feels like, you know, when you're talking about something as kind of universal as divorce, that we remake it and maybe we see more from a woman's perspective. Maybe we see more from, there's no character in here who shows like what a working woman looks like. Like, this was, even though they try to talk about things that were in kind of like the cultural zeitgeist of the time, like therapy and obviously the, you know, the effect on the kids, right? One of the kids is like, oh, all my friends have come from broken homes, so it's no big deal. But they never mention about like women in the workplace.
I think it's interesting, too, that you mentioned that. My favorite character is Dee Dee, and she is a sex worker in this film. And she is a boss. She's her own boss, literally. But she, you know, lives alone in this, like, two-bedroom apartment. She has so much agency over herself, over the space. She commands the room. Side note, Richard's friend sucks. What's his name? Lionel? What?
Yeah, Lionel, I think. Yeah.
Lionel is the worst friend. He is an enabler, but essentially what happens is he takes advantage of poor Richard. Richard is drunk off of his butt. I don't know if we're allowed to curse on this.
Of course. Why not?
Drunk off his ass in a bar. And he admits to his friend Lionel that he's never been unfaithful. Way to go, Richard. Love that for you. And Lionel's like, well, maybe it's time. And Richard is so drunk. Lionel takes him to Dee Dee's house. Dee Dee's a sex worker. Apparently, he frequents Dee Dee. He's a client of hers. And she, though, is so awesome. She, like, has agency over herself. She's like, hell no, Lionel, you're being a bad friend. Get him out of here. He's too drunk. Like, this isn't fair for him. And she was, like, protecting Richard. And I think she was the only working woman that we really get into in this film. And I think that's kind of boss.
Yeah, what a strange scene. And also Lionel's view that, like, well, no, it's not cheating.
You're not holding hands.
If it doesn't mean anything, it's just, but man, Richard is just so uptight. I think they had sex twice in their marriage, and it resulted in the two kids. And
those two kids.
And that was it. Yeah.
Heartbreaking.
played by Gary Getzman and Tim Matheson. Gary Getzman, the founder of Tom Hanks's production company.
It was a well-connected family.
Nice little performance. Yeah, they really were. They really were. We're now in 2024. And we're talking about a remake of this movie. So how do you feel about relationships, marriage, divorce today, how it's evolved, has it evolved?
It's a really good question. I think it's interesting, and again, this could just be the bubble, the social circle that I'm in, but I am seeing polyamory on the rise when it comes to married couples, partnered individuals, even individuals who identify as single, but they have multiple partners. And that, to me, I feel like would have blown people away 40 years ago, 50 years ago. Oh, my gosh. What's math? It's 2024. 1967. Ben, help me out here.
Yeah. No.
Is that 60 years?
10 years ago was the 90s. Don't ask me. Yeah.
God damn it. But essentially, yeah, it's when speaking about relationships, about partnerships, polyamory, I feel like is so, I don't want to say trending. I'm just seeing it everywhere. And I personally don't identify as part of that community, but a lot of my friends do. And they have said that it has saved their marriage. It's made them closer. It has made them see their partner as a human being, as a partner, as opposed to the old ball and chain that they're tied to and they're stuck to for the rest of their lives. They're two individuals growing together. And in this process, if they have multiple partners, maybe they will grow apart. Maybe they will get a divorce. But I've heard that when they've begun typically with polyamory consensually, and they both agreed to it in this communication, then it opens the gate to conversation and there's a healthier separation if there needs to be one.
Yeah.
So I think we're in a really interesting place. This is also coming from me being a single woman. I've never been married. So who am I to say? But this is what I've observed.
Yeah. I mean, I also have a lot of friends who are poly or have non-traditional relationships, have a primary partner but also date outside of that. And I totally see the potential benefits of that, of not seeing your partner as needing to be everything for you all the time. And that just as you have friendships outside of your partnership, why couldn't there be other romantic or casual friends with benefits situations with other people outside of that? It takes questioning those traditions that we've been handed down, the expectations and the assumptions of what a long-term relationship looks like. That makes that sound weird, right?
To me, it's what it comes down to is just talking about, like, of course, ethical non-monogamy, of both people wanting to explore it And it does feel scary because it is a change of the status quo, as we talked about. And the status quo has been, male, female.
Heteronormative.
Heteronormative, thank you. Heteronormative relationships. You get married, you have kids, that's it. So as soon as you bring into, one, maybe I am not heterosexual, maybe I am bisexual, pansexual, whatever it may be, that's scary and changes the status quo for you and your partner. And then maybe you have feelings for multiple people. Does that make me flawed? I think this is actually a nice segue. One of my favorite quotes is in the movie, Barbara confesses to Richard, I think I'm addicted to sex. And maybe she is, but she hasn't shown any symptoms of that, of sex addiction in the film. I think she just, like any human or some humans, enjoys having sex. And she hasn't been able to have sex with her partner because they've not had a connection. So it's really interesting of what is considered bad, what is considered not normal. And there must be something wrong with me. And so I feel like with divorce, people who want to see other people, something is wrong. They think something is wrong with them. And no, maybe it's just a different lifestyle choice. As long as it's, I don't know if I'm making sense. I'm rambling now. That's where I'm at.
Yeah. Wrap it up. I mean, I'm glad you brought up polyamory and kind of different views of relationships and younger generations. I think still, though, there is a general expectation of marriage and kids as like these tangible life achievements, just like buying a home. Like it's a lot harder as we like just now. It's like it is a lot harder to explain like why polyamory or ethical non-monogamy or whatever these different ways of managing relationships, like why that is beneficial. Whereas like you look at a traditional marriage structure and be like, no, I get it.
Yeah.
You know,
because like, I think I'm just not I haven't seen enough of it. I've been fed heteronormative relationships and marriage all my life. I've just recently in the past 5 years been exposed or been surrounded by ethical non-monogamy, polyamory, seeing the benefits of it. And yeah, I think it's just kind of practice of changing your perspective on relationships. What does it mean? I think this is also really interesting. Ben, when me and you were chatting about this movie, about this project, we were asking the question, why are you single? And I, someone who is single, have been asked that question so many times. And I find that when people ask the question, why are you single? It's because they have an expectation of, why did you break away from the norm? Most people are partnered. Most people want to be partnered. So why are you not partnered? And it's interesting, that question is rarely turned on its head. You don't really ask someone, why are you married? It sounds like an insult. Or it sounds like you're questioning someone's relationship. And then they're going to get bristled. And how dare you ask me that? Because I'm in love. Because we love each other. Because we're partners. That can just be as easily said for the question, why are you single? Because I love my life. I love myself. I really enjoy this time. Or maybe too, maybe my end goal isn't having a partner. Maybe that isn't the happily ever after. Maybe living solo is just as valid as of a lifestyle choice as having a partner. Granted, this goes into Ben and I, what you talked about, marriage is different than partnerships. Marriage is society. Marriage is a contract. There's legal stuff. Partnership, however, is a whole different conversation. But yeah, I think it's interesting when it comes to the norms, the expectations. Why are you single? No one else is. And yeah, expectations versus reality.
Although you did just tell us earlier that a lot more people are single than we think.
And yes.
As of 2020, so many more people are single. And yeah, partnership and marriage are two very different things. And the evolution of marriage in the eyes of the government has changed a lot over the past, 53 years? Something like that?
I don't know.
Since 1970.
I majored in acting. I can't do math.
Well, yeah, a little over 53 years since 1970. but honestly, not much, you know. And there were major feminist divorce reform movements in the 70s and 80s that tried to essentially soften the blow for women coming out of marriages who maybe the only benefits available to them were, as we said, you know, Social Security if they were married for a certain amount of time, or
that's nuts. I didn't know that's like a tenure for a relationship.
Yeah,
or being in a union for a certain amount of time, you get your health insurance.
Exactly. Exactly.
Get through an abusive relationship just long enough.
Just long enough.
You'll get some money.
Yeah. And maybe you get some property out of it. Maybe you get alimony and child support. And then they got some small victories along the way. It was interesting to learn that that's where Cobra came from. Cobra came out of women being able to stay on their husband's health insurance. Their employer provided health insurance after after divorce, of course, for a price. Right. So some of these benefits are also really only available to women of means or any person of means and time and energy to spend in court fighting this out if they have to, you know, access to private pension plans. But there isn't still, as, you know, we complain about all the time, there aren't universal programs. There isn't a universal basic income. There isn't universal health insurance. So it is still just these little selective benefits that makes, like, having been married, you get certain benefits that are not available to either married people or single people, right? It's this, like, they've carved out this other status.
Yeah.
As opposed to, making benefits available to everybody, regardless of status. It was now something you had to, like, achieve.
Yeah.
Or making, like, moral arguments for, like, who is deserving of this versus, you know, we can just guarantee things for everybody. And then we don't have to, like, fight against different factions or make moral arguments to get certain things. So that was really interesting to read in the book about, like, how these efforts shifted from, like, oh, well, we can't go after the, you know, Reagan's not going to do anything for women, so let's try to focus on, like, state victories and you know, try to make the judiciary and legislative changes where we can. And get victories where we can. But it is really sad that, I mean, the National Organization of Women in the 90s fought for single-payer health insurance and, you know, Clinton couldn't pull it out, sadly.
God, the one time. Yeah. I feel like also, too, it's interesting how we can change our entire life structure based on just getting health insurance, of getting cheaper rent. Maybe I'll move in with somebody because I want to just be able to afford food so I can split a studio apartment with somebody or whatever it may be. Having to adjust your lifestyle choices just for basic needs is wild. That is the American divorce.
Yeah, I mean, in the movie, in the scene when Nelson is explaining to Richard the situation with his ex-wife, and for her, she's like, "Well, I'm still single because of economics, because I make more in alimony and child support than I would if I, like, married some schmuck." Right. And we have made our feelings on that very clear. But it is still an economic question.
Yeah.
In 2024, like, can we afford to be single? Life is getting more expensive. Childcare is getting more expensive. Women are expected to work now. Mm-hmm. Right. And take care of the kids. Right. So it is very hard to be single. Especially if you want to be a parent as well. So where are you at now? I mean, do you have any interest in, like, do you imagine yourself married down the line? And we were talking about partnerships, and, like, those partnerships don't even necessarily need to be long term. If you want to enjoy life as a single person, you can still have any kind of relationships you want. Or I should say, not a single, but an unmarried person.
Yeah.
You still have whatever relationships you want along the way.
Totally. I think to answer your question, it's been really lovely living my life for myself on my own terms in the past, I don't know, 32 years, and not feeling like marriage is an end goal. Fortunately, I never really felt pressure from family or friends to get married. It was never something I dreamed of growing up. I know I had some friends who had wedding books growing up, of having a wedding dress that they wanted. They would save, you know, a Pinterest board of future weddings, and they weren't even dating somebody. That was never it for me. But I'm a huge advocate for connection, for close friendships. partnerships, for family. So I feel like it's been nice to change that narrative and that perspective of wanting genuine connection with human beings. If it's romantic, great. If it's not, also great. I don't know if marriage is for me, though. I think it would only be for me because I'd want the hospital visiting rights. Because I would want, I don't know, if I died, like my estate to go to somebody. It's things like that. However, I do love weddings. I love
weddings are great.
Ritual. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So not the contract, but it could even just be an exchange of vows of this is why I love you. And I want all my friends and family to see that I'm committing myself to you because I love you. So I don't know. I think that's kind of where I'm at. I feel so blessed to be in my 30s in 2024 because I feel free. Like I feel empowered. I feel very fortunate to be a woman in 2024. Of course, there's things that we're fighting for every single day, but I don't know, I feel like I'm in a good place. How do you feel? You're recently partnered.
Yes. Yeah. And going well. And we've talked about, she asked me a couple of weeks ago, do you want to get married? Not like she wasn't down on one knee. She asked if I wanted to get married and I was like, well, I'm reading all about like divorce right now. And and it just sounds very complicated.
Yeah.
But I obviously see the value in long-term partnership for sure. Like whether or not we make that contract with, you know, the government, mm-hmm. to be recognized as being married. I don't know, but I absolutely want for myself a long-term partner for sure. And then maybe, yeah, defining what that looks like down the lines of, you know, is it a poly relationship? Is it ethically non-monogamous, whatever, and defining that for ourselves. Right. And not falling into any kind of traditional box or assumed way of being. But what I was going to say in terms of being untraditional, and I'm glad I finally talked to my mom about this, but I asked my mom, I was like, so like what happened when you and my dad got divorced? Like, obviously you got divorced. I know that. Yeah, happened. Yeah. But and I was certainly aware of the emotional underpinnings of everything and the emotional fallout. But from a financial standpoint, I got to learn that they came to it in a very mature and like thoughtful way of like, well, we'll do this because, you know, we want him to keep. It was actually him needing to stay on her health insurance.
Okay.
And the house is going to stay in her name for whatever reason. And that they basically just split everything evenly.
Love
and
that.
And kind of settle up at the end of the year of each year, and mm-hmm. you know, whoever had earned more would basically owe the other person, you know, because they were both, my mom was working all my life as well, so that made it a lot different than this movie and a lot different than other marriages as well. And it's so funny, speaking of being untraditional, like they would tell other people about this arrangement and they'd be like, we've never heard of anything like that. You know, and certainly they've heard horror stories from other couples and my mom's heard horror stories from other women and family members who have had divorces much, much worse mm-hmm. than that, and have had to fight for what they feel they deserve out of a relationship. And it was just like, wow, I mean, we didn't want the divorce to happen, but if it had to happen, and was ultimately the best thing for them, then it's good that it was able to kind of end that way on, okay, well, let's settle things with kind of a maturity and understanding of this partnership as it was, and not leave it up to, you know, the courts to decide.
Oh, for sure. And it makes me so happy to know that. Because they didn't separate, you know, recently. This was, you know, years ago when you were growing up. But it still probably wasn't the norm of people, as you mentioned, to talk about it openly, for it to be an amicable or maybe not amicable, but a healthy separation. What's so interesting in this movie, too, the most adult characters are the children, in my opinion. Because the kids, you mentioned before, Ben, of course, Barbara is so concerned, like, are you going to be traumatized over this? And they're like, no, a lot of my friends come from broken homes. Do you want me to be traumatized for this? And it was so interesting. They, both of the kids, treated it like, it's okay, Dad. Yeah, Mom has a boyfriend, but, you know, he's cool, but you're cooler. Like, I don't feel bad, Dad. But it's interesting. Sometimes, you know, the kids can be the most adult coming out of it.
It was definitely the view of the time that kids would be resilient. And I don't know that that's still the view.
I don't know. Yeah, it's a good point.
You know, I certainly didn't. They divorced when I was in college. So it wasn't like it had this massive effect on me, you know, mm-hmm. being transported between homes or something like that growing up, you know, the week spent with my mom and the weekend spent with my dad. It wasn't like that. So I feel like I don't have those kinds of effects, whereas like these kids are into their teens, so maybe they are able to rationalize it a bit better and kind of wrap their heads around it, and yeah, they have this cultural understanding of it because all their friends are going through it too, but I imagine it's a lot harder for you know, kids coming from lower socioeconomic mm-hmm. Status, or just kids that are younger, you know, 5, 6, 7 years old, but it was definitely the view of the time that like the kids are fine.
Yeah.
Well, I know we got to wrap up shortly. We can't wrap up, however, before we talk about our American moments.
Of course.
They're playing our song.
What did you pick out?
Cars. That was my main thing. Is I was also too, I'm such a nerd about branding of like, okay, is there a Coca-Cola symbol somewhere? Is there a product placement? I didn't see a ton of product placement. I don't know if that's
I think he did get a Coke when he goes to the fast food place. Now that you just mentioned it, because I because I skimmed through the movie again. I was like, did I miss anything? And I think, yeah, he does get a Coke from the glass bottle. It was very classic.
The glass bottle. So good. Yeah. Because it's moments like that. Or what are the American brands? Coca-Cola, Chevrolet. That's American, right? Did I just make that up?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, great. Chevy, yeah. But yeah, so these classic American brands that you see just going through suburbia, that to me was just very quintessential. Or the barbecue setup, where they're having barbecues at parks, at birthday parties, bowling, these American pastimes. I feel like, do they go to a baseball game?
Yeah, they go to see the Dodgers, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's so many different American pastimes that they've experienced because that is suburbia. That is just being an American, is these stereotypical events and activities. You would probably not find those activities in divorce Italian style.
No. They have walkable neighborhoods and it's much more multi-use. It's yeah, much more comfortable there. You don't need a car to get around.
That's the life.
I always find an occasion to talk about how cars ruin cities. But yeah,
they do.
Cars, not just the presence of cars. And of course, this is an LA movie, so not surprising that cars are getting everybody around, although you then see Nelson having to take the bus because he's so, you know, he's so down on his luck, which is like, as if like
it's a bad thing socioeconomically. Status.
Yeah, right. And cars as a status symbol for sure. Mm-hmm. You see as they're coming out of the bowling alleys, like
he's in a VW, which I love.
Yeah, Richard gives his kids and Nelson's kids, like, oh, take the car, you know, go have fun. And Nelson gives Richard a ride home in this barely functional, like definitely not street legal VW Bug, where the door's coming off and the seat doesn't have, like, it goes all the way back. Like, it's not.
The art department had a field day. Like, art and props were like, I got this.
some great physical humor from Jason Robards, for sure. Yeah, you mentioned the baseball scene. I always have to pick out a baseball scene in these movies. We have another scene in a mall, which I didn't...
Americana.
Yeah, like especially American malls. And we had a whole episode about the American mall. Great movie. And talked about how, like, yeah, the rise and fall of the American mall. It is really a unique invention, the way that... these suburban malls sprang up and all the parking around it, and it just, oh boy, it's a mess. I definitely recommend, there's a whole section on this, and the guy who brought the concept of the mall to America in Henry Grabar's Paved Paradise.
Is it nonfiction?
It's a nonfiction book, yeah. Paved Paradise, How Parking Explains the World.
I'm writing this down.
Definitely check it out. And it made me think about our episode again. Because I feel like, yeah, malls could be so wonderful, but it's all the parking.
It's all the parking.
I think about my mall growing up of just like, oh, just endless parking lots, endless empty parking lots around this like little...
this little central hub. It is wild too, like how that was our pastime growing up, because like we didn't have a lot to do.
Yeah.
you're just gonna go to the mall.
Yeah.
We went to Syracuse, the Mall of America. It used to be called...
Mm-hmm.
Mall. What was it used to be called? Carousel Mall. And now it's Destiny USA.
Yeah.
America.
Exactly. And we talked about that on the American Mall episode, how it's like those big, massive, like, it has to be a destination now. You have to have things there that you can't get elsewhere. You have to have roller coasters and museums and arcades and all these...
laser tag?
Yeah. But the traditional malls where it's just like what you see in the movie, in Divorce American Style, where it's just shopping, that just doesn't...
That's capitalism. Just not really... That's American.
...a thing anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Consumerism.
Excellent. And divorce, I guess. I tried to look up and see, you know, where our divorce rates fall among other countries.
Ooh.
But I like...
Should I Google it?
I guess I'll have to come back to that. I feel like it's pretty in line with a lot of other, especially European countries.
Well, it also depends on the marriage rates themselves. So if like in Sweden they're not getting married as often, maybe the divorce rate is low? Because they're not even, I don't know, ratios, math, BFA acting.
Yeah, right. Film film major. So
nailing
nope.
it.
Statistics. Yeah, statistics. I'm proud of us for the statistics that we pulled out on this episode.
So am I.
Yeah, well done. So much to talk about. This is definitely our longest episode in a while. Yeah,
all good stuff, all gems. You can't edit anything out of here.
I'm not making any cuts.
Mm-mm.
No cuts.
The pregnant pauses, keep them.
Haley, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and I'm so glad you picked this movie. Again, thank you so much for being here.
Ben, thank you for having me. This was such a delight to watch the movie, to learn from it, to do the research, to chat with you about it. Thank you so much.
And thank you so much for listening. If you like what we're doing, please give us a rating. Leave a positive review. You can give us your unfiltered opinion on Instagram @AmericanScenePod. And we'll see you next time.